Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter Murray, and this week we are looking at two stories. Firstly, we're looking at the Eye's coverage of the war in Ukraine, or rather, the Eye's coverage around the edges of the war in Ukraine. We'll be talking to Anthony Goldman, who pulls together the Eye's Letters From page every fortnight, with correspondents around the world, particularly in places which have been falling foul of Russia in recent years. We'll also be talking to Dr. Grimm, the Eye's human rights correspondent, about how Russia has been using its clout overseas and gaining influence in the process, particularly in various African countries. Later on, we'll also be talking to Jane McKenzie, one of the Eye's correspondents, about a victory of sorts for Private Eye. It's the story of the government's catch-up tutoring program for school pupils who have been disadvantaged by COVID due to absences, school closures, that kind of thing. There has been a development in the story, which Private Eye, and particularly Jane, was predicting would need to happen. The bad news is she's been predicting it should happen for about a year. The good news is some progress seems to have been made now. More on that later. But first, Ukraine. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine about 6 weeks ago now, the Eye's Letters From page has focused on a number of other countries, some of them bordering Russia, some of them not, and examine how Russia has been manipulating those countries diplomatically and militarily, and how events in Ukraine fit a broader pattern of Russian interference. I spoke to Anthony Goldman, who runs the Eye's Letters From page, and asked him what was his thinking when pulling together the Eye's coverage since the war began.
Well, look, I think that the idea was, what can we say that people don't know, given how much is being reported on the ground and how quickly events in Ukraine were moving, and things like sanctions and those things directly related to the conflict. So we're looking to our correspondents around the world for illustrations of what's been happening in plain sight and perhaps not as picked up as perhaps it might have been. And so, for example, you know, we went to neighboring countries, to Moldova and Georgia, which have had experience of Russian intervention in the past. We went to Central African Republic, where mercenaries of the Wagner Group, which are now operating in Ukraine, have been on the rampage for several years. We had a look in Kazakhstan, by no means a Western-style democracy, not looking to join NATO or the EU or anything like that, but also accused or under fire from voices in Russia as having not being a real country, that Russian speakers are under threat. Very familiar themes. And also, most recently, with Damascus, and to have a look at actually what a country looks like after an attempt at pacification by Russian forces.
It's been absolutely fascinating to see those patterns emerging. So you mentioned just there Kazakhstan, which, as you say, very completely different kind of country in lots of ways, but it has these things in common. So the border with Russia is about 5,000 miles long, nearly that. Lots of people ethnically Russian and native Russian speakers. And so the recent column about that described exactly how Russia has been trying to intervene. Can you talk us through that a bit?
Yeah, so this idea, look, 20% of these people, 20% of your population are, you know, are Russian speakers. Russia, you know, saved you in ages gone by from the East. Putin telling Kazakhstan it wasn't a real country. And as in common with some of those former Soviet republics to the west of Russia in Europe, this idea that these former Soviet republics are looked at in a very different way from the administration in Moscow than they are in those countries themselves, and more widely still. And this sense, Russian communists, you know, talking about liberating Russian speakers in Kazakhstan, a country that, unlike some of those European capitals, has always been staunchly pro-Moscow and has actually been quite friendly towards it. And when there was trouble in Kazakhstan earlier this year, it was Russian peacekeepers that came in to stabilize the government. So it was a turn up for the books that actually, in a country that is not keen on protest, there were actually some anti-Russian demonstrations off the back of what's been happening in Ukraine, and a fear, I think, amongst some people in Kazakhstan that this won't be easily or quickly forgotten in Moscow, and that while Vladimir Putin remains in power, there is a risk of some form of tension brewing in the future, something that's similar in Tbilisi, in Georgia, and in Pristina in Moldova.
It's really interesting how much language comes into it, because that was one of the main observations made, certainly between 2014, with the annexation of Crimea and the war in Ukraine's two easternmost provinces, was that, well, these people are Russian speakers, and therefore that gives Moscow a say over them. This campaign in Kazakhstan, or the, you know, quasi-campaign that's being run, one thing you observed is that the supposed closure of Russian language schools in southern Kazakhstan was seized on by Moscow as evidence of a threat to ethnic Russians in Kazakhstan, despite the fact it wasn't happening. There weren't mass closures of Russian language schools. So that's one really interesting parallel. The other, in that particular letter from Almaty, was about whether these countries are recognized as countries from Moscow, which you touched on there. So in 2014, Vladimir Putin said that the Kazakhs never had statehood. It wasn't. And again, there's that sense, exactly as we've been seeing the rhetoric with Ukraine, these countries on the borders with Russia aren't really countries.
I think there is that sense about Russian identity. And I think this is as much about trying to understand what makes Russia Russia, or what Vladimir Putin thinks makes Russia Russia, and this idea of, you know, a greater Russian identity, and that, you know, the culture of Russia is bound up in its people and its language, and that the nature of history doesn't neatly fit into the world that has ebbed away from Russia after the end of the Soviet Union, which Vladimir Putin said was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century. And I think that, you know, whatever you might think of that, it seems to be quite sincerely held, even if the consequences of it, you know, around the borders of Russia, and to be honest, you know, further still as well, in places like Syria, in places like Central African Republic and Mali, are quite profound. You know, there are real life consequences from this existential notion of Russian identity, and how it is preserved, and how it presents a threat to the motherland, if you like, even where these people are in, you know, according to international law, according to established borders, other countries. But if you don't see identity in those terms, then I think that you end up, as we've seen in Ukraine, an attempt to create statelets that don't really exist. We've seen the same in Georgia. We've seen the same in Moldova. The Pridnestrovian Moldavian Republic is established by the Russians.
Yes, let's talk about this. It's really interesting. I'm going to let you say it again, because I think of it as I've heard of Transnistria. Are these the same thing?
Well, Transnistrians are the people who Russia, you know, this is a Russian-backed breakaway republic of pro-Russian Moldovans between Ukraine and the Dniester River. It's a tiny strip of land that is kind of handy for money laundering and spooks. Private Eye is in the business of satire, and there's not much that's funny about war. But, you know, when you establish the Pridnestrovian Moldavian Republic, it's hard not to think that someone is looking at the world in a particular way, because this doesn't make any sense, really. I mean, this is not about creating identities or protecting states. It's about creating an environment that fuels instability across borders and within a region.
So the region now known as Transnistria, which is this sort of tiny strip of land between Ukraine and the bank of the Dniester River, was established in the early 90s, shortly after the Soviet Union fell apart. Seems to have been Russia supported, is that correct, this breakaway attempt?
Yes, I think, as we put it, Transnistria is the USSR's last joke on the world. A shabby House of Soviets that has a puppet government with, you know, spies and money laundering, and constantly ignoring UN resolutions about what the future should really hold. I think, in a sense, these are the kind of things, warning signs that were flashing, that perhaps when they were ignored, you could see perhaps in Ukraine, Russia might have picked up mixed signals and perhaps thought it was, you know, if it was all right in Transnistria, if it was all right in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, that perhaps, you know, this was their way of doing things. And to be honest, as we've been trying to look at in Private Eye over the last few weeks, it is how Russia does things. It's how it does things on its fringes, and increasingly it's how it does things in an extension of Russian power in other continents as well.
Yeah, and it's exactly what you say there. The these feel like dress rehearsals in much, much smaller territories. So in 2020 in Moldova, again, much smaller country than Ukraine, much lower population, documents were leaked which showed that Moscow had been supporting a pro-Moscow candidate trying to be elected president, Igor Dodon. As it happens, Dodon didn't win the election, but that's exactly what happened in Ukraine. You described in a different column, it happened in Georgia as well. There is the strange sense of a playbook emerging, which has a set rhythm, a number of steps to destabilize, gain influence, and kind of slowly push that sphere of influence as far as it can go without obviously admitting it.
I think that the system of government established in Moscow under Vladimir Putin is different from the Soviet era, not just in terms of, you know, the rhetoric of revolution, but also in terms of, at least formally, moving away from, you know, a one-party state to have the trappings of elections, but in a much more managed way. So I don't think that there's any doubt about who is meant to win an election in Russia or how they're meant to win an election. And I think that model of managed democracies has been exported to quite a few other countries around the world, and certainly even in parts of Europe as well. And I think it was the model that Russia hoped would give it the protection, or the protection for its interests and its peoples, or Russian-speaking peoples, around its fringes. But in Moldova, money actually wasn't able to trump a broader will of the people. Even a country that is closer still to Russia and much more vulnerable in a military sense, Georgia is a very, very small country, but even with an extraordinarily influential kind of oligarch behind the scenes controlling the key levers in security forces in the interests of Russia, the crisis in Ukraine has highlighted, you know, the tension between what Moscow wants, how its puppets or how its proxies try to protect those interests, and the broader will of the people. That there is a sense in Georgia, for example, of, you know, impending catastrophe. I think that's partly because Georgia always has an impending sense of catastrophe during history. But I think that that sense that actually one or two worms have turned, that people, you know, politicians who I think progressives felt, you know, were in Russia's pocket have actually turned up and said, no, we do want to join the EU. No, we won't close down the Ukrainians. And I think that the events in Ukraine, I think for some of these countries, has brought into sharp focus, you know, some of those issues that perhaps they had hoped for the last few years were just going to go away, perhaps in the same way that in London and Germany and Washington, people, politicians, looked at challenges that they felt they would much rather not deal with today, and have ended up having to face the much more awkward consequences in the here and now.
And that kind of brings us on to the other aspect of the situation, the more military one, because the places where Russia has been, if you like, making more military dummy runs for the kind of campaign that's been going quite poorly for them in Ukraine, is further overseas. So places like the Central African Republic, places like Mali, and of course Syria, where they have made much smaller interventions, but against much weaker opposition. But there seems to be a playbook in operation there as well, would you say?
Well, look, in Syria, Russians are not the only external agents fighting. But when there were denials from Moscow over targeting civilians in places like Mariupol, it was familiar to people in Damascus that had heard similar denials of more than 300 airstrikes and artillery strikes from Russian forces, that Russia has perfected this form of, or the military strategy of using air power and shelling to destroy any kind of form of normal life in urban areas. And actually, some of the commanders who developed that methodology in Syria have been promoted and are now on the front line in Ukraine. In terms of the hand-to-hand combat, Wagner Group is typically described as a Russian private security company or mercenaries, but it's quite clear that they have very close ties with the security establishment in Russia and a sort of an informal arm, if you like, of the Russian security establishment. And the method of operating in Central African Republic has been, I mean, brutal doesn't begin to cover the level of violence, the impact on civilians, and the level of brutality, the rape, the killing, and also the response when anybody pokes their nose in too closely. The journalists that have been killed, the use of social media to kind of flood networks with fake news stories to discredit opponents or hostile coverage to Wagner. These things are well established in that part of the world, and we've seen them reappearing now in Ukraine as well.
Anthony Goldman there. Another I correspondent who has been covering the Russia story from a slightly different angle over the last few weeks has been Dr. Grimm, the I's human rights correspondent. She has written pieces about Russian intervention in various African states, and one of the most recent was about Russian intervention in the Horn of Africa, in the country of Eritrea. I spoke to Dr. Grimm and I asked her what links Eritrea, a seemingly unrelated country many miles away, with the Russia-Ukraine war. Here she is.
Well, I've written about Eritrea before, of course, because from a human rights perspective, it's a completely awful country. It's got, you know, no independent judiciary, no legislature, no freedoms at all, dreadful military conscription, brutal army conditions, so forth. So it's, you know, this is a pretty tough place, and it's a one-man state. But I was quite interested to see that they voted for Russia, along with various other states that most of us wouldn't want to live in. And so I sort of looked into it a little bit more, and it seems quite clear that a lot of analysts think that Russia is using various means to befriend states like Eritrea. But more specifically, rather than befriending a country in perhaps the old-fashioned way, when you might go in and offer sort of state relationships and support, what this is sort of leader to leader, and the Russian state appears to be supporting leaders whose position doesn't have any real legitimacy in terms of, you know, public support. And so he's going in and making them reliant on him, really. And it was interesting that just before Russia invaded Ukraine, the Russian foreign minister went to Eritrea, and nobody knows quite what they talked about, but most people feel that they can guess. And this is all to do with, we'll supply you with arms. Would you like arms? And then, of course, Russia's winning not only influence and friends, and possibly in Eritrea's case, a port, you know, on the Red Sea, which is hugely strategically important. But they're not only winning that, they're winning votes in Africa. And Africa's got 54 votes at the UN. And this is almost, not quite, but almost a sort of swing vote if you can get Africa on side. And we've seen it, you know, very recently, Russia was ejected from the Human Rights Council by a UN vote, but 17 African countries opposed that or abstained. And so you can see the effect of Russian influence and this idea that there's a greater plan. This is like a game of Risk where, you know, you can imagine the Russian state sitting there and thinking, okay, where's NATO? Where are the people that don't like us? How do we go around them? How do we have someone on every side of them? And there are analysts suggesting that this is all about, you know, the capability to distract NATO on its southern borders when you want to, when you need to.
And one of the striking statistics that you mentioned in your piece on Eritrea is that Russia has supplied 49% of Africa's arms purchases since 2020, which is a huge proportion.
Yes, it is. I mean, of course, someone else is supplying the rest, you could yes. quite reasonably point yeah. out, and there aren't those many people who could supply arms in that quantity. But I think it just shows you what Russia's interest is. And when you look at the situation in Mali, you see something happening which has happened before, where they use various means to make their appearance there look legitimate. So there's disinformation, there are polls to suggest that Russia, or more specifically in the case of Mali, Russian mercenaries are being invited in, that this is what the public want. And then you start to get this situation where something that's kind of at arm's length from Russia, even though everyone knows it can't really be, no one really believes you could run a private, powerful, successful, wealthy private mercenary operation without very senior people in Russia being happy for that to happen, and indeed quite friendly with the idea. So, of course, these sort of arm's length parties go in and do terrible things, actually, and support terrible things in order to keep a person in power that will then be loyal to Mr. Putin. But what's so sad about that is that, you know, the people at the bottom, the ordinary people of the country, are just pawns in the game.
These missions that are launched, like the one you mentioned in Mali, the Wagner group there, are they ostensibly fighting rebels? There's a kind of rebellion that they're putting down.
Yes, I mean, there's always sort of instability at the heart of it. So in Mali, there's been a jihadist uprising, a nasty one, in central Mali for a long time. And, you know, the Malian army are, you could say, quite legitimately fighting against that. But they're doing so in a what we would not regard as a decent way for an army to behave. They're targeting people by ethnicity and assumed loyalty to jihadists, and then going in and massacring and behaving very badly. And it appears that the Wagner group, which is this Russian private military contractor, are very closely involved in that activity. They're appearing just as it's happened. They're there, they're seen, they're supporting. So they're not necessarily doing it, although some reports suggest that they are, but more consistently, they're just around. They come in on motorbikes at the end after the death and destruction. So, you know, it's very nasty, and it's very, you know, you start to realise that what you're seeing is a wish to gain power that actually has no human empathy, that doesn't care at all about what happens to the people at the bottom. And of course, we've seen that with Russians' involvement in Syria, where they've controlled the skies for years, and much of the terrible stuff that's gone on in Syria could not have gone on without Russia's support. They could have stopped much of that any time. So it's quite clear you're dealing with someone who actually doesn't care at all about human suffering. That's not what this is influenced by at all.
Just to go back to your Malian example, you mentioned that the strongman will gain a bump in stability against the jihadist movement. Russia obviously gains a lot of arms sales, good for the economy, and you said gains influence over these nations in places like the UN. But there's something else, isn't there? There's a mineral aspect to this.
Oh, yes, huge. I mean, I should have mentioned that. And in fact, the man who is said to be in charge of the Wagner group, although this is denied, but nevertheless, the man who is said to be in charge also owns mining companies. And they have been given licenses in places like Sudan in return for their military help. So this is gold, diamonds, uranium, aluminium, precious metals. And Africa, of course, is a huge source of resources. But it's also, you know, if you're mining for diamonds and gold and platinum, that's a huge source of money to fund your military machine, particularly when you're sanctioned and you can't obtain dollars or spend rubles.
Really, this sounds like the next phase of imperialism, where in the end of the 20th century, former imperial powers withdrew, and that has, to a certain extent, left a gap to be exploited.
I think so. I mean, it's a shame that it's a gap, because it was supposed to be an opportunity for independence and, you know, engagement and equality and a sort of liberal model of the world. And for me, one of the really horrible things about this is that if a country that doesn't believe in that, that believes in oppression or totalitarianism or, you know, a very different approach to what individual human beings are worth, if that sort of country is supported enough by other people like that in other countries, you could reach a stage where actually there are more countries that are like that than not? And then what's normal, and who gets to choose? You know, are we just a minority with our model of rights and human decency? So, yes, I think you're right. I think it's a huge power game, and there is this sort of terrifying feeling that we've seen a brief flowering of democracy and liberalism, and it might just all tip the other way again.
Dr. Grimm there, and there'll be more on that story in the eye in the fortnights to come, no doubt. Now we turn to a slightly more cheerful story, the story of what has happened with the government's tutoring program. Jane McKenzie has been covering the government's catch-up program for COVID-hit school children for about as long as it's been in existence, and she's been covering its deficiencies, so much so that actually she appeared on the podcast roughly this time last year talking about what had gone with it already. I spoke to Jane and I asked her, first of all, if she could remind us what exactly was the problem last time we spoke before getting on to what might be the problems this time. Here's Jane.
One of the major issues was that a large part of the tutoring programme was being funded in the most absurdly convoluted way, where instead of funding schools that who could provide appropriate catch-up for different children, what they were doing was funding the private tutoring sector to be able to offer subsidised cut-price tutoring that schools could then buy if that was how they chose to use their very limited amount of pupil premium money.
Yes, and you were saying how expensive this was going to be and how a lot of the tutoring services being charged were really quite pricey, and that schools weren't really free to fund their own way of doing it, if you like.
Yes, so the very sort of first version of the National Tutoring Programme, there was some option for school-led tutoring, but most of it was to be done through this partners program where you would use these various different private companies that were included in the partners that you could buy. Some of them were very pricey, especially for what they were offering, which wasn't always a particularly premium product, but they were charging what would be quite expensive. And then after the subsidy was very similar in price to what it would cost a school to, say, buy in a supply teacher to take a small group of children out to do some catch-up work.
Right. And it was one particular firm called Randstad who were then chosen to provide, to sort of be the main tutor, if you like. Is that right?
So Randstad were brought in for the second year of the scheme.
Ah, this is a development since we last spoke.
Yes. So the first group who were running the scheme was this consortium of charities. That sounds very noble, but they're more think tanks than charities. And in one way, they're sort of research endowment bodies that hadn't previously provided a service anything like this.
Right.
They ran the first year of the scheme and it wasn't tremendously popular among schools because they thought they could do a lot better with the money themselves. But they thought they were going to get the second year of the scheme as well. They'd even appointed the former head of Ofsted to be the boss of a new trust that would run the second year for them. And then the government gave the contract to Randstad instead, who are a multinational HR company.
Okay, so it sounds as if March 2021, you've identified the problems with the first year of the scheme and how it might not have been doing a huge amount of good or as much good as the schools themselves might have known, you know, how to target their resources. The contract's handed over to Randstad. What happens next? A multinational human resources firm, they sound pretty good, don't they? They sound like they'll be tutoring away like billy-o.
Tutoring away? Well, in many ways, they were completely hamstrung by the weird setup of the scheme. I don't know that, honestly, you could run it in a way that schools would love because it was just a ridiculous setup in the first place, but they didn't make it any better. The take-up was poor, especially in various areas of the country, in particular the north of England, where a major issue was there aren't that many private tutors in the first place. So in terms of there being a private tutoring industry, it's quite often around those areas of the country that, for instance, have 11 plus, and therefore there was a private industry for wealthier families who wanted to buy in private tutors. Some areas of the country the only people who do private tutoring are people like music teachers. So this scheme is looking for people who private tutor in maths. That's just not a business in some parts of the country. So it was quite difficult to get the numbers that they were supposed to be providing tutors to schools. So they were certainly missing their targets, their performance indicators, and so on. So it was seen as, you know, oh, the company's failing. But really, the overall issue is that the scheme was failing because it wasn't set up to make any sense. It was terrible value for the taxpayer, who was just paying for a huge subsidy to go to tutoring firms. And it was hamstringing schools that didn't necessarily want what the tutoring companies were offering and didn't necessarily have the money in the school budget to buy even bargain tutoring.
When you talk about really low participation rates, one figure that's been published is that the National Tutoring Program might have reached just 15% of its overall target. And considering that the overall target is to deliver 2 million children with tuition, it's an enormous challenge. But it seems to have been enormously missed.
Yes. Well, imagine you're the head of a school where children desperately need some catch-up, but they also need the breakfast club that your pupil premium pays for, and they need the classroom assistance that your school budget needs to pay for. And you think, well, do we cut those things in order to pay some private company to send some tutors that we don't necessarily even rate? Or do we just do our best to do the things we can do within the school's budget?
So kind of similarly to last time, where the problem was there was only one option really presented to them, which was too expensive. The schools had the autonomy to spend the money that they'd been granted.
They have their pupil premium to spend,
yeah,
but they weren't being given the money that goes into the National Tutoring Program to spend. That was still being given to the tutoring companies in order to help them offer a lower price to schools.
So the government's post-pandemic education recovery program is worth about £5 billion. That's the amount spent on it. Randstad received a chunk of that, but have not delivered for various reasons that you've said, as in some of it might have been their fault, some not, but for whatever reason, they have not delivered that amount of tuition. And that money is kind of going unspent.
Yes, but
spent by government, I should say, not spent on tutoring. Yeah.
Fortunately, the new decision, at long last, is that in a shocking moment of genius, they've decided to let schools decide how to spend the tutoring money. I mean, who could have possibly thought of that?
Can we chalk this up as a quote-unquote victory for the eye?
It would be nice, wouldn't it?
It would be.
We weren't the only ones saying it. Every head teacher, yeah, you spoke to was also saying it. So it's not like the DfE have come up with the most whizzy idea that they could. But it's nice that they finally listened to someone, whether it's us or the heads. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, who knows at this stage? It seems like it could have literally come from anywhere, because everywhere was saying that this was the main problem with it. So this feels all right. Let's remove the victory from the eye banner from the front of the building.
Well,
but this feels like a bit of good news.
It does feel like a bit of good news. I mean, there could be more money spent on catch up generally and on sort of helping schools that are really generally struggling with the budget to keep up, let alone catch up. It's some extra money going into dealing with the amount of education time that's been lost over the last couple of years, that at last, hopefully, the people who know best, i.e. the people who are dealing directly with the children who've missed education, the teachers, will be able to make decisions about.
There is one final slight twist in the tale, which is that although schools are going to have this freedom, as you described, to work out what the children in their care need, tutoring-wise, the DfE are going to be offering out a smaller contract, which is going to be for, you know, quality assurance and recruiting academic mentors. And it's entirely possible that Randstad could bid for that contract too, and then win it.
Yes, they could. I mean...
Okay. there's a potential that we're going to be back here in another year's time talking about how that's gone.
Yes, there seems to be no end to the DfE's belief that the people who can best come up with ways to provide education are somewhere outside the education system. The lack of faith in the education system and the people within it and its massive expertise in education is sort of unending. They're convinced someone out there they can buy from that will be able to do something that the heads and teachers and everyone in the education system hasn't thought of.
Well, Jane, thank you so much, and I'll see you in April 2023 when we're discussing what's happened next.
It's a date.
Jane McKenzie there. Thanks to her, to Dr. Grimm, and to Anthony Goldman for their contributions this time. We will be back again with another episode of Page 94 next month. But until then, if you find yourself in need of criminally reasonably priced investigative journalism and jokes delivered to your door once a fortnight, all you need to do is go to private-i.co.uk. There is a big red button. It's not actually red. It's just one of the tabs, but it says subscribe. That's the main thing. So why not go there, click on that now, and make yourself part of the growing army of iSubscribers. Thanks again for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you again next time. Goodbye.